Hi, this is Megan Francis, and you're listening to the Kitchen Hour podcast. I'm here to keep you company while you get dinner on the table and help you set aside more time for family, food, and fun. Hi, everyone. It's Megan Francis, and welcome back to the Kitchen Hour podcast. It's been several months since the last episode. Yes, we had a bit of a hiatus there, but now we're back and relaunching just in time for holiday cooking season. We've got a great lineup of guests coming up, and you can expect a podcast every week from now on into the indefinite future. I had kind of a crazy season last year, I guess it wasn't last year, it was this year, but it feels like a year ago, last spring, where I had some health issues. I actually had a diagnosis of very early stage cervical cancer. So I'm totally fine now. It was completely treatable with surgery, but it's a good reminder for all of you to get your yearly physicals. Those kinds of things can be detected early, and I'm very lucky, but it was kind of a traumatic experience in the spring, and a few things kind of fell off the radar there while I was having surgery and recovering and just kind of getting back on track. But now things are great, and I am looking forward to Thanksgiving and Christmas and just this whole season coming up. Another big change, my main site used to be called thehappiestmom.com, but Sarah, my managing editor, and I recently did a complete overhaul, and now the site is thehappiesthome.com. The main content from the Kitchen Hour is now living at the Happiest Home. If you go to thehappiesthome.com, up at the top, you'll see the categories from the site, and there's one that says the kitchen. So a lot of the content that used to live at thekitchenhour.com is now just kind of been looped in with all of my main content about motherhood and family life and parenting. I decided to rebrand the site because I just felt like I was moving into a phase of my life where I'm not just focused on sort of the mom stuff and the little babies, but also just this idea of having a closer family life and a more satisfying home life. And I felt like the new title just reflected more where I'm going and the kind of content I want to cover and the topics I want to cover. So we're doing more things like home organization, and there's some decor in there. There's still lots of mom stuff, more food, some entertaining, just lots of really fun things that don't all necessarily fall under the header of mom, but are more family oriented, and lots of parenting content. So it's really been fun. It's been a great experience changing over to the new site, and I'm hoping that you will check it out if you haven't already. You can also still find the podcast show notes at thekitchenhour.com. So you can go to thekitchenhour.com/podcasts, and you'll find all the podcasts there. And then you can also find today's particular podcast if you go to thekitchenhour.com/episode12. Okay, so let's just jump into today's interview. And remember, you'll find me here again next week with a new episode. So please do come back, subscribe. You can listen in iTunes, or you can listen right on the Kitchen Hour site. You'll also find links to the podcast at thehappiesthome.com every Wednesday from now on. I'm so excited to be back and excited that you're here with me. I'm here with Candace Walsh. She is the author of Licking the Spoon, a memoir of food, family, and identity. Welcome, Candace. Nice to have you here.
Oh, it's so great to be here. Thank you.
You know, I've been reading your book, and I'm not quite done with it yet, but I have to say it's so unique. I don't know that I've ever read a memoir that that incorporates food in quite the same way as this book. And one of the things that I kept thinking of while I was reading it was, you know, I wonder if, are these, you know, does food stick out in your mind more tied to certain experiences than maybe it might for a not as foodie of a person? Like, for example, when you think of a childhood memory, do you automatically have a food or recipe tied to that?
I think, you know, with childhood, I could see my mom cooking, but it was still sort of a mystical thing, like where the meals would just land on the table 3 times a day, and God bless her for that. I'm a mom. I think I developed into somebody. I think my memory was definitely a memory where I retained food details. But I think that as I got older and I found myself connecting to food so happily, you know, just in a creative or giving or experiential way, I think that you know, that formed the nut of the book. And so I did some retroactive beefing up of just how the role that food played. It was definitely true, but I just, as a kid, I think I was also thinking about, you know, playing outside and
right.
my dog. And
yeah, it's funny because you're right. Like, you don't think, you know, when I think back to my childhood meals, I can definitely see some themes and appreciate a lot more of the work that went into it. But then it was just, you know, come to dinner at 6 o'clock and sit down and shoved into your face. So, yeah.
I know, as an adult, you know, I do think about it in terms of future experiences. Like when we travel, I think about, you know, I do research about restaurants, and living in Santa Fe, we have a wonderful food scene, but there are limits. So when I try to fill in the food experiences that I can't have at home, and I also try to hit places that are doing, you know, interesting things, and just so that I can have those experiences that I'm hearing about.
Right.
So you think going forward now that it's very much a focus.
Right. Yeah. So let me ask you about the process of writing a memoir. I mean, so let's talk about the book, first of all. It starts way at the beginning, like even before, it starts with your grandmother's generation, right? So it's your, kind of tells us, like sets up the story of your family history.
Yes, 1 second, my cord just fell.
Oh.
Yeah, it starts before my, it starts with my great-grandparents on my mother's side. Luckily, I had enough information about them to talk about their stories. The reason why I did focus on those things, those stories, is because I felt like they were my ingredients on the food theme, that those people and their experiences and their life stories were the ingredients that went into me. And to be able to include their stories is really to be able to continue my own.
Mm. And I loved, you have a metaphor in there, and I can't remember exactly now what it was, but was it your father who was Irish, came from an Irish family, or was it your grandfather, your father? And then your mom's family was Cuban?
Greek and Cuban.
So then you said something like they mixed together about as well as corned beef and cabbage and spaghetti pita or something.
Yeah.
I love that, sort of using the food as, because it is funny how certain ethnicities seem to have that food culture that doesn't, it's not just the food, it's the personality somehow.
Oh yeah.
Tied up in the food.
The culture. And so I think Greek people are very clannish, and I think they would have been happier if my mom married another, you know, a Greek person.
Right.
So I don't think there was anything, there was no like West Side Story. But it was, I'm sure it just didn't help things to meld.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So you had kind of a, I don't want to use the word dysfunctional childhood, but you know what I mean? Like there were some rough patches. Your parents divorced and then they both remarried. And it doesn't sound like either remarriage was particularly.
Well, I think, you know, I think that one of the marriages was, it's still going strong and that's awesome. But yeah, it's interesting because when parents, can divorce. And I honestly think that a lot of the negative stuff that happened really happened before the divorce. I think they really kind of needed to find different paths.
Right.
But where was I? So yeah, they basically, I think for me though, I think it was good that I was getting towards becoming independent because I needed to get away from their values and, the way they looked at the world in order to feel like I could really grow as opposed to going just, you know, up towards being 5'6". I needed to grow in lots of other ways, and that wasn't a really good environment for me. I think that happens for a lot of people. They get up into the world, they start figuring out what works for them and moving in that direction instead of feeling like they have to negotiate all sorts of directions with their parents who have different values and different ways of looking at the world.
And so was it during sort of your teen years when a lot of the stuff seems like it was getting maybe coming to a head in a certain way that you started to find yourself drawn toward cooking? Is that kind of when that all happened in a way that you can mark?
It actually happened when I went to college because I went through the sort of phase of being a freshman and just being overwhelmed and going to the cafeteria and feeling happy that something was being provided. Then it's, you know, cafeteria food in college, unless you're going to Cornell where the culinary school provides the food probably not going to be the best food for you. So, you know, I kind of went through that like, oh, this is this sort of passive, oh, yay, you know, tater tots.
Right.
Yeah. Lasagna. To moving out into my own apartment with friends and having a kitchen at my disposal that nobody else in the house was interested in, except for a place to recycle the beer bottles or not.
Right.
But it felt like this playing field, this playground, actually, you know, somebody who was thinking about pinching pennies as a college student, I went from, you know, buying tomato sauce in a can to trying to make my own. There was a garden in my rental house's backyard, and I was like out there picking tomatoes just because I'm like, hey, this is free.
Yeah.
So I got, and then, you know, the most beautiful thing was that I would make a big old meal, and my college friends who were starved for home cooked food would just be all over and very, very complimentary. And so I think it was probably a way to feel secure and appreciated at a time when everything was so up in the air in college. You're just basically waiting for the real world.
Yeah.
But it felt grounding to me to be able to take that on.
I remember that first, you know, year of college. I think I ate more chicken strips that year from the cafeteria than I've ever eaten in my life.
I know. But the best part I remember was like they had this big industrial stainless steel vat filled with orange juice.
Oh,
we
yes.
Just like tank up on orange juice.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Because for the first time in your life, you have like unfettered access to any kind of food you want in any quantities you want.
It's not like, leave that orange juice for your brother.
Right. Or like when I was, you know, when I was a kid, my mom would only let me drink orange juice out of juice, you know, the tiny little juice glasses. She would never let us pour it into a tumbler or any kind of large cup. So then here I am at college and I've got those big, huge, you know, they were still warm from the dishwasher. You know what I'm talking about? Those big plastic cups.
And they're all scratched up with a smooth rim on top.
Yep. Fill them all the way to the top.
Pint plus of orange juice.
Exactly. That's funny. Well, I could see how that could happen. And my second year of college, we ended up living in a house with several other people. And one of the roommates was prone to cooking. And it was like, whoa, you know, we would all just wait around for her to buy. But then we didn't have any money to buy like real ingredients either, which was, and we didn't know how to shop well. So you just go shopping and you blow all this money to make this kind of one meal and that's it. And so it's like, oh, that's all the money we had. So
I know one time, I remember one of the first few times I went to the grocery store, somebody who lived off campus, I was going with my friend who's in the book, and he just laughed at me because every single thing I bought was both white and a dollar or less. That was like a bag of white rice.
Yeah.
Loaf of white bread.
Yeah. That's funny.
It wasn't cauliflower. just that kind of like, hey, it's a bargain. And
right.
I think I've definitely bought some pasta, some spaghetti on sale.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just sad.
Yeah. Well, I remember in my, you know, early 20s after just like kind of, you know, that young married life section of time when I think my grocery budget was like $43.50 a week or something. I mean, this was in the 90s, but still it was ridiculously small. And it's just so funny. I mean, it's hard to buy anything besides pasta and rice and beans on that kind of budget.
It sure is.
Yeah.
I go to Whole Foods. They always get me to spend at least $40. I don't understand.
Yeah.
Even if I want two things.
Right. Yeah. I don't live near Whole Foods anymore, which is probably just as well for my budget.
Yeah.
So.
I started there like a guilty little bandit.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Yeah. It's so beautiful and the way it's laid out, you know, it's just the shopping experience there.
I need that.
Yeah.
Have to have it.
I'm trying to think if it was Whole, cause it's been a while since I've lived near one, but I think it was Whole Foods that had the section where you could get, like a lot of spices but you could just get them like in little packages. So you could try new. Is that right? Is it there? Like you could get them in these little plastic pouches. So you didn't have to spend money on a big jar of it.
You don't have to spend like $6 or $7 on one jar of something that you're going to use a quarter teaspoon of.
Right.
And then so, you hang on to it for 12 years because you feel guilty getting rid of it, right. even though it's rancid.
Right. So I think I ended up with like seeds of paradise or something. I don't know, some, you know, very esoteric ingredient that I'm not sure I ever found a recipe to actually use it, but I probably could now with the internet being what it is, but yeah, that's funny. So, okay. So in the book, now we've kind of gone through the college age, the college years, and then you did end up you got married yes. to a man named Will and had a couple of kids. And how old are your children now?
They are 8 and 11.
8 and 11. Okay. And so tell me a little bit about the second half of the book, which I haven't really finished yet. So without giving spoilers, I mean, I know how it ends up, but.
I know, right? let's see. Well, I will say that in my 20s, I went from, I would say that in college that I went, I got really into The Enchanted Broccoli Forest by Molly Katzen because I was vegetarian sort of socially and financially. And I also thought, and on some level, I think it probably did help. I was, you know, conscious of wanting to be at an acceptable college weight. So I did the whole, you know, vegetarian because all my friends were vegetarian and it was cheaper and I felt like it would counteract the beer intake. So, and that was great. And the funniest thing about Twitter is that you can just connect with these people. I saw Molly Katzen on Twitter and I sent her a tweet and with a little link to the book and like a little very brief explanation of her role in the book in my life. And she was so nice and retweeted it. But so that is, I mean, I think when I was reading her book in college and making her recipes, I just never thought I'd actually connect with her
Isn't
like
that.
Isn't that
funny? The world has shrunk in many ways because people are accessible in a way that they never were before. And celebrities, you know?
Yeah. It's like.
Oh. I'm having some connectivity. I'm sorry. I think I just had a little bit of a connectivity problem there for a sec.
Okay, did you hear? Let me back up.
Yeah, just go ahead. Back up to when you started talking about when you were just talking
after
about
college?
No, I think we were fine up until the part after you were talking about reaching out on Twitter and connecting with her, and then from there.
Okay.
Okay.
Good. So, after college, I was poor again as I was looking for a job, and I was living in the Lower East Side in this little tiny apartment, and so what I ended up doing was eating rice and beans. People talk about your salad days, but I couldn't afford salad. I remember my friend asking me to stop at the grocery store and get her some arugula on the way over to visit her in the city, and I thought, I don't even know what arugula is.
Right.
Really hope she pays me back. It sounds expensive.
Right.
Of course, now I've got it all in the fridge. But so I was living in this really awesome Dominican neighborhood. And so rice and beans, the whole neighborhood smelled like delicious rice and beans. So I was making them not as well. But it was really a time when I was both eating strictly to stay nourished without any level of like, ooh, this would really be really it wasn't about being delicious or about being creative. It was just about staying alive. And at the same time, I would walk past all these restaurants. I'd walk past like 80 restaurants on my way home of every kind of cuisine, and it was torture. And when it got colder, you'd walk past and the door would open, this big wafts of steam of like French food would come out. Ugh. Was like, oh, I felt like an urchin. So when I got my first job at a German bank as technical writer, I was able to buy food and try recipes. And there was a store, Rizzoli, in the complex where I was working with amazing cookbooks. So it was a time when I could flour and cook for friends again, but this time with more sophistication, and I was eating meat again, so I had more options in that way. And so I kind of went from like, you know, the poverty piece to trying different stuff, and then really latching onto Martha Stewart, which is so funny because here I was, this like 21-year-old, you know, little brat in a in a terrible sort of, you know, terrible.
Weren't you kind of in like to the thrift store yeah. shopping and exactly. funky glasses and all that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was doing that and had like ran around with like a TWA flight bag as my purse. But I would just, if we started talking about Martha Stewart with anybody, I'd just go on and on and on. And I think I was just really craving her, what seemed to be a very sorted out, very privileged and tidy and kind of knowledgeable life.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think I wanted to have a blonde bob and you know, always wear Polo Ralph Lauren or whatever, but I just really, I loved her grasp of the options and the beauty of what she was doing. Mm. I remember looking at her magazine that my roommate had, and I was just shocked and kind of fascinated by the fact that she devoted 2 whole pages of her magazine to different kinds of rice, and the rice were like blown up to maybe, you know, the size of the first piece of my pinky.
Right, so you could
all
see
all these different yeah. colors and shapes and names, and I was just like, wow.
Yeah.
To go from the rice for 99 cents to...
Right. And it is seductive, that Martha Stewart thing. It's you know, it's like the perfection that none of us probably... even really want.
Oh, I know.
Like, you can kind of dream about having it.
It makes me anxious to yeah. be in those kinds of environments, really. And I don't like, I mean, when I was nesting, when I was right about to have my babies, I went through these cleaning frenzies. And then that was like maybe the only 18 hours of my life that I actually, I think, really resonate, you know, really was a potential Martha Stewart person.
Yeah.
Scrubbing
and spending a lot of time thinking about like different classifications of like, you know, lemongrass or something. And it's like you're just getting into these very nitty, but it's for someone who's, I mean, if you devote your life to the exploration of all, you know, of the specifics of these things, and it makes sense just for the rest of us, it's kind of like, well,
well, yeah, but I'm kind of, I got a bunch of things burning.
Right. So, exactly. And yeah, you know, no. I did read the section where you talked about Martha Stewart's entertaining and right. her, you know, the way she was dressed. And is that the book where it's like a very imposing sort of dark wood everywhere?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I can see it in my head.
I wish I had it nearby, but it's, you know, she's like wearing gunny sacks. It's such a moment of time of like,
right.
you know, Connecticut 80s preppy
privilege.
Yeah, and she's like she's wearing all this white lace stuff, and she's got probably some kind of a white headband, and then her napkin and her tablecloth kind of match her outfit.
Yes.
She's all, look.
Yeah.
I, you know, one thing I learned was that although I really have some wonderful go-to recipes from Martha Stewart that I use to this day, overall I think that it was so aspirational in general that it lost sight of the fact that people might say, you know what, I just spent $80 on this meal and it took me 3 hours and it wasn't so great. It
wasn't, right. right.
You know, I almost feel like maybe there was some sense of like, well, these people aren't going to cook these things. It's just sort of entertainment.
Right.
So as I started to really value, because I worked every day, I mean, well, you know, 5 days a week, even though I look back and I go, God, I worked 5 days a week. I wasn't married. I didn't have kids. And I would come home exhausted and feel like, you know, wow.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
now it's like, I do that and I have kids and I'm married. So, and I have to cook really. But, so yeah, I started to feel like I needed to have an economy of financial, you know, outlay for a meal and
right.
time outlay. And then what's my return?
Right. Yeah, that totally makes sense. But, you know, one thing that I was thinking of when I was reading your book and when we were just talking about things like not knowing what arugula was, right?
Yeah.
It feels kind of like in decades past, and I know I'm a little younger than you, but I also grew up way up north in sort of this very small town environment, so we were probably like 10 years behind everybody else. But I feel like meals were so basic. Like ingredients, you would go to the store and you would only really maybe have 2 choices of what kind of grain you were going to get or whatever. I mean, there weren't all these options, and people didn't even know about the options. It wasn't even like you would feel bad because you didn't have a certain kind of ingredient and you didn't know it existed.
Yeah,
or our parents didn't know it existed.
Or like rice-a-roni if it was
right.
really Right.
They just cooked what they had either grown up cooking or what they read about in a magazine, which was usually pretty basic stuff. So I think maybe part of the intoxication of the whole Martha Stewart like movement was all of a sudden you had these magazines full of beautiful pictures of, you know, heirloom vegetables that you would never even have thought about. But like you said, then after a while, you just kind of burn out on it because there's so many options. How do you ever explore and indulge them all?
It's like you have to expand and then contract back in again, kind of taking what worked for you.
Right.
And I absolutely agree. But the funny thing is, sometimes that was my ceiling. We're in a snowstorm, so.
Oh, gosh. It's not going to fall in on you, is it?
No.
Okay, good.
Knock on wood. The inspection was very positive. But so where was I? Because that just blew my mind.
You were talking about contract.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Go There's ahead. Something really wonderful about like Meatloaf Monday and,
right,
you know, fajita casserole Tuesday. And I tend to, you know, my kids are, I share custody with my ex-husband and they're with me every other week. So, you know, when they're with us, it's like, okay, what are the kids like? And, you know, last night I was making a big batch of homemade chicken fingers, you know, but like doing it with organic chicken and,
right,
and all this stuff just to keep it less processed. And it's not hard and the kids love it. I think it probably tastes better to them. I feel less guilty. So I know, I think about just without having that sort of Meatloaf Monday structure that doesn't have any room for experimentation or mood or whimsy, I do feel like it's so liberating to have a plan.
Yeah, I think
and I'm still working on to being consistent with that, but you know, it'll probably be like hamburgers with broccoli and then I'm not the kind of mom. I think it's probably because my parents or my dad was very controlling about us finishing what was on our plate, whether we liked it or not. You know, it's very interesting to balance my own desire to cook gourmet-ish or interesting, innovative meals when I do cook and have to actually go, well, these kids, you know, I have to respect where they're at with their taste buds and I can challenge them to a certain extent, but I have to be compassionate about, you know, their memories and their associations of food and how that's going to affect them for their whole lives. So maybe it really will be pizza, but we'll make it from scratch or, you know, it won't be all the time. And so that's, as a mom, that's just something that I've had to come to grips with. It's a dance.
It is. And you know, I think too, like you said, there is that respect. And then there's also the not freaking out part, because I think those of us who grew up maybe either with parents who kind of made us lick the plate or without a lot of variety, it's like the new parenting, the new way of parenting now is to get really anxious about like exposing our kids to ethnic foods and exposing our kids to all these flavors. And then there's this feeling like if you don't do that, you're somehow failing. But, you know, I didn't, at the age of 6, I wasn't interested in eating the way that I eat now. I ate very plain food when I was little. It evolves. We evolve. So it's like exposure to it without a lot of expectations, I think, is a really healthy balance.
Without being like, do you like the kimchi?
Right. Exactly. I think sometimes like modern parents, we kind of need to get over ourselves a little bit. And just because not everything, I mean, yes, nurture is very important, but not everything we do is going to have like an immediate measurable sort of like effect on the way our kids end up in 20 years. It just doesn't work that way.
And just as an example, if I am somebody who pretty much will eat anything,
right,
you know, or at least try it once,
mm-hmm.
and I'm somebody who didn't like, you know, vegetables or I only liked the broccoli tops and not the bottoms. And,
right.
And I, you know, I liked things like just chicken with a very bland, creamy sauce and rice and, you know, like I said, the broccoli tops.
Go ahead.
To say that, like, it just goes to show you that it's really not connected.
And when I was a little kid, I can remember what it felt like to taste a Brussels sprout, like very clearly in my head. And I love Brussels sprouts now.
Yeah.
Might have also been the way that everything was cooked to death in those days. But I can remember tasting it and being so disgusted.
Oh, there's some kind of gag reflex that we have as kids. I remember I liked regular carrots, but not cooked.
Oh, God, me too. Ugh.
And my son the other night just said, I don't like sweet vegetables, you know?
Yeah.
So he doesn't like many, but he definitely, I could commiserate with him about that. And I'm just now to the point where I like green beans because they came in these frozen blocks and they would get boiled to, you know, somewhat mushiness and ew, like, but now to be able to get haricot vert nice and fresh from in the springtime from the farmer's market and just like blanch them. Delicious. So it's kind of a combination of us for whatever. I mean, maybe in like 15 years, scientists will show that, you know, studies will show that there's a like specific reason why kids are repelled by certain flavors.
I almost kind of believe there has to be a reason for it because it's such a universal thing.
Yeah.
That it's like something is going on there biologically. And even if I gave my kids, you know, and my kids actually do like vegetables. I'm not, I mean, it's, I've been pretty lucky in that regard. They eat pretty healthily without, but there are certain things they just cannot, like the sweet vegetables thing. You know, I'll roast carrots. I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys are like candy. They're so sweet. My older kids are gobbling, like literally fighting over them. And then the younger ones are like, well, we don't like sweet. You know, to them, sweet is fruit.
Right.
So a sweet vegetable freaks them out. And I remember feeling the same way about cooked carrots when I was little.
Yeah, so. And now I like sweet potatoes and yams, but when I was a kid, it just was like, ugh.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So there must be something at play there. And who knows developmentally what's going on. But yeah. I try not to sweat it too much. My daughter basically lives on apples right now, so.
I know. They'll survive.
Yeah.
So just to continue to kind of talk about my path with food.
Sure.
So I did the kind of post-college mini gourmet thing and with Martha Stewart and starting, you know, feeling like that was just too much fuss for not enough return many times. And also just being like, oh, I paint one of my three rooms in this tiny apartment, like robin's egg blue, but I still don't live in a sprawling mansion. So I have to think about feeling, you know, looking for other gurus, so to speak. And so at that point, I met my first husband, and he's half French. And he's like really into wine and worked in a really high-end wine store. So we started cooking together, you know, doing food and wine pairings for dinner every night, which was fantastic. And it made me aware of new recipes, and all the people he worked with were like complete. They were like probably pre-foodies. They were foodies before it became so
universal. Anyone used the word foodie?
I know. We would just go to like dinner at their houses and it would be so blown away that I knew that I had to return the favor, and it would just be like, oh, I've got to up my game. So Danielle Boulud's cookbooks really came into my kitchen and saved my life because they were a little fussy, and they did have several steps, but gosh, the results were just amazing. And so I started to pay attention to not just lots of effort, but strategic steps, strategic methods of cooking and ingredients and flavors. So that gave me confidence and when I was pregnant with my daughter, I went through all sorts of things where I felt too crazy to think about food and or I'd have a crazy, crazy craving. But when I was like in my due date month, which I thought was my due date month, and I actually ended up giving birth in August. But I made this huge brunch, basically hoping that I would tempt fate to put me into labor.
Oh, I know.
And
that
it was
feeling.
For Bastille Day. And so it was one of those things where I was kind of nesting and I was kind of thinking this is like the last time I'll be able to do this for years without having to think about other little people who have their pressing needs. So I made three different chilled soups and I put them in shot glasses so that they looked like and arranged them like they were the French flag.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And I made all sorts of little finger foods and tarts and that was kind of a last hurrah for a while in terms of that level of cooking and entertaining. So then 9/11 actually happened when my daughter was 5 weeks old.
Oh my gosh.
And like, so we were in the East Village. So that was a huge shift for me. It was so sad for everybody. And it was also something where a lot of people had, you know, their lives changed. in ways that they certainly didn't choose. And so Will and I, we spent a year in Long Beach, which is funny because they just got hit so hard with Hurricane Sandy.
Oh my
gosh,
right.
I was just reading an article about how there, and it's in the New Yorker, and this philosopher is talking about how so many of us, and I think moms can definitely feel this way, they think about the life that they're not living.
Right.
You know, and they compare it to the life they are living, and it makes them feel bad. And it's just BS, you know, like live your life. Don't think about, oh, if only this and if only that. And I think for a long time, I thought about my life in New York as the life I wasn't living. And then I spent a year in Long Beach, which was pretty close to my family. And then Will and I moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, a year later. And so there was a part of me also that was thinking, oh, you know, gosh, what if I stayed in Long Beach? Maybe I'd be closer with my family. You know, my kids could play with my brother's son. And did I make the right choice? You know?
Yeah.
But, well, hello. I'm really glad I didn't hit, you know, I wasn't sitting there when Hurricane Sandy hit, because that would have really, it's still terrible. They're still recovering and they will be for years. So, tangent, but, and I do love, so I've been in Santa Fe for 10 years and I really feel like, it's really my home. A lot of changes have happened since I moved here, and I had my second child, Nathaniel, back in 2004. So I went from just having one child to two, which is always interesting. But of course you have so many kids that you're like, yeah, honey.
No, that's all right. Going from one to two is, to me, that was really much harder.
Shift, right?
Yeah. I know it's interesting. Some people think it's like the hardest to go from no babies to one, but that, for me, that was fairly easy. I mean, you can carry one baby around with you and they fit into your life pretty easily, I guess. But the second one, man, that knocked me for a loop.
Cause then you have like the relationship between the two of them and their relationship with one and the relationship with the other.
And yeah. And you never really feel like you're doing enough for the older one. At least that's how I felt at the time.
You're
and
used to being able to give them so much and they're used to giving them so much.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
As eldest, I know that I took, until I had kids, I didn't get it. I was like kind of resentful about being, you know, not the only child anymore. But, so that was interesting because the first time I was still kind of bopping around in the city with my daughter in a sling and doing my thing. And with the second one, suddenly I had the station wagon and which I wanted.
Right.
It's really cute. Still drive it. But, you know, I really felt like people were, you know, being in this new town and missing like my past life and having to adjust to having two kids and also really noticing that my marriage had some serious problems.
Right.
It was a tough time and I really didn't cook that much at all. And there were these expectations around what I should be doing as a mother and a wife. And how I actually felt. I mean, I certainly took care of the kids' needs and I knew that was my primary thing and that it wasn't negotiable and I enjoyed it. But I think that we as women in this society have, there's all these like unspoken expectations, even with partners who are really progressive. I think we fall into old habits just because they're so ancient. And I remember like having a really long day with the kids and going to nurse Nathaniel to sleep and falling asleep. And it was about 9 o'clock and my ex was like, you know, you're asleep. I'm hungry. I thought you were going to make me an omelet. And I was like, yeah, I offered to 2 hours ago, but you weren't hungry. So I'm going to bed now. And just to have that conversation is just so unpleasant.
And I think sometimes too, it's like, we all know we should be somewhere. We should have moved on from that, but like the world hasn't caught up yet, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, we all know if you really broke it down and said, hey, do you realize you just woke your wife up and told her to make you an omelet at 9 o'clock, like, you know, how ridiculous that would sound to anybody, but it's, I don't know. You're right. It's like, there are these old ancient patterns that you can't just really get past in a generation or two.
And parenting when it's stressful, which it has its fair share of stress. And so to, you know, because you're not just being, it's not just that the parenting it's stressful. It's like the head of the household responsibilities. And
right.
I think when we're just hungry and exhausted, those caveman and cavewoman behaviors can come out pretty easily. Mm-hmm. Like, what just happened?
Right. Yep.
But, so, that was, I think, a period of my life that a lot of moms can relate to. And I would have to say that even though I get hit with the occasional dose of baby lust, I'm 40 and I think my body's like, hey, last call.
Yeah, last call.
Like, yep. That sounds like a great idea, except what?
Right. But,
I think that that's a period of time people can relate to. And yeah, like I think it's so nice to have the kids be older, and my daughter will wake up and make waffles now, and she's very proud of herself. And my son's very interested in doing stuff in the kitchen as well. I think his interest, I think his hygiene habits have to catch up with his interest.
Yeah.
More freedom.
Yeah,
I know. Wash your hands.
You know, you're right, though, like the baby phase. And it's funny because in case listeners don't know, Candace worked at Mothering Magazine for how long? 6 years?
6 years.
6 years at Mothering Magazine. And when I think about Mothering Magazine, I associate that so strongly with that newborn period of motherhood with not so much the last two, just because by that point I was already kind of in the big kid stuff as well, but more when the older ones were little and it was just me at home with, you know, 1, 2, 3 small children. And there was this simplicity that sometimes I look back on now and I feel really nostalgic about it, but it wasn't simple at all. It just felt simple. It was like, it was hard.
The simplicity was the priority.
That's true.
The priorities. It's like when people complain, my friends had kids and they're not the same.
Right. Like, no. They're not. Yeah.
It's like, okay, these are the priorities and everything else goes by the wayside. And I actually have a picture of, me. It's hilarious. A picture of me that was taken at Trader Joe's when my kids were little, and oh my God, I look like I'm 50 years old. It's so fun. Can I show it to you?
Yeah, go ahead.
Show it to the audience.
Well, they won't be able to see it because it's just audio, but I'll see it. And then I can put it in the show notes. You can send me a copy of it.
Well, the hilarious thing is, that,
okay, move it over a little bit. Okay. Oh my gosh. You do. You look like you're about 15 years older than you are now.
I know. And I have like really bad, I got desperate and I got that, those hair frosting kit.
Which doesn't help.
No. Like, when does anyone actually get frosted hair in nature?
Right.
But
exactly.
The funniest thing about this picture is that it was hanging in Trader Joe's for, I don't know, 6 years or something. I didn't even know it was.
Did you have a blog post about this or a Huffington Post thing? Yeah. Yes. I read about that. And you felt violated by it or something.
Should I say what happened? Is it okay?
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Somebody drew a big male genitalia graffiti picture next to my face. And it was hanging there for 6 years on this cork board by the bathroom. And I just think it's so hilarious that, and sad, that, you know, that somebody would do that with the mom, two little kids who obviously looked like she was compromise.
I had better days. Yeah.
And then I would just sit there and nobody would think to take it down. So I took it down after I like ran away in horror.
Yeah.
And it just sort of says a lot about our conflicting feelings as a society when it comes to parenthood and how to respect mothers and, you know, respecting them in a sort of a like, Madonna and child.
Yes.
Way is so different than actually supporting them in ways that can make a difference when they have so much on their plates. At least that's what my take home was.
Yeah.
Maybe I overthought it, but
it could have been just some drunk 20-year-old kid too. But the fact that nobody took it down, that's what, not even an employee.
I know.
I mean, I guess I wouldn't go around taking things off of the bulletin board at Trader Joe's either, just because I wouldn't feel like it was my place. But if I worked there, I would. You know, someone had to see it.
Yeah, you know. So.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting time. But you're right. There's something so lovely, and I think what I do want to remember more are those afternoons where like the sun's coming through the window, and you know your little one of the kids is like building a block tower, and the other one knocks it down, and they both laugh, and you've got a little sweetheart sleeping on you, and it's a beautiful time.
It is. But you know, you're so right about not wanting to necessarily go back to it now that I have older kids, and I do feel like now I can cook and I can do, and just little things like, oh my gosh, I turned in all the kids' permission slips and homework folders and stuff on time this year. Like, what? You know, that never used to happen. I was always so chronically just scattered because I had small children, and the older they get, I do feel like the more freedom I have in space, mental space and physical space. So
I actually have a calendar on the wall and I write dates down like, okay, there's this recital in 3 months, which is like so nice.
And you're like, whoa, I'm actually going to make it to that. And I'm not going to forget. Or maybe I will, but I'll still make it.
At least I wrote it down.
Yeah.
It's like a total surprise.
Well, I totally forgot to do a break, but that's fine because we've been having a fascinating conversation. I definitely want to get to like the latter part of the book before we wrap it up. So I haven't finished the book. However, I do know, well, I suppose it's fine to give a spoiler because, you know, you've already said you divorced your husband.
Yeah.
And I know that you're remarried now. And so there's a surprise. If you don't know Candace, maybe it's a bit of a plot twist, as you will. But so as much as you want to share about the book, the end of the book, without, you know, giving too much away, I'll let you decide.
Sure. My marriage ended, and I know that although it was a really, they're always tough. You can't have I'm sure people do have very simple, carefree divorces, but
I don't know those people.
Even though I wanted to, it didn't, it still had repercussions for years that made me sad. And even though I know that, my ex and I are so much happier with our new partners, even when everyone's happier after the divorce, it's still just a really tough transition. So I heard that it takes something like 3 years to really get over it. And that sounds about right.
Yeah.
Even in the best of circumstances. So, but I found that the divorce was like a rebirth for me. Not just because of the expectations that that particular marriage and relationship placed on me, but just because I had been, you know, coming out of a very broken childhood, I really clung to stuff that was very, very traditional. I just wanted everything to be normal and nice and perfect. And I didn't stop and think about, well, what do I actually want? Hmm. You know, it was more like, I want that picture, you know, out there, but it wasn't like looking, I didn't have the capacity to look inside and really claim what I wanted as a person. So, when my marriage ended, I definitely had an opportunity to do that. And I honestly feel like Santa Fe is a place where people, it's just in the air. You're encouraged to, just, you know, be true to yourself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't even drive anywhere without 15 bumper stickers telling you to follow your bliss. It's constantly, it's a very pleasant hammering. And so I thought that was true for me. And I had always been attracted to women on some level. And I always kind of instantly pushed it down because it just was too disruptive. I went through my college experimentation phase. And as much as I didn't want it to be an experimentation, once I got out of college, I found that you know, the forces of society and my own lack of an anchor as a person just led me to go into the more conventional directions, and just fear. I mean, as somebody who felt so insecure in my 20s, guys are going to, you know, hit on girls, whereas I kind of would have had to hit on girls if I
Right.
Liked. And that was terrifying.
It was more of a sure thing with the guys, right?
Yeah. Those things happened.
Right.
And if I wanted to date women, I would have to make that happen. Unlike it looks like on the L Word. You know, there was no like awesomely hot butch girl who was like chasing me. It was more like, where's that one gay bar and one so good night to go? And this is just too overwhelming. But so Santa Fe didn't have any gay bars, but at least there was the internet at the time. And there's a large community of gay people here. So I was able to connect with that community. And it was totally like going through adolescence again. Going to like a dance, like my first, it's like junior high, first dance,
right?
35 years old, first dance for women at this old folks home for gay people has like this really cool lounge bar, which is funny and weird. But at the time that was like the venue, and just so surreal. So I made a lot of friends and I dated several women, but nothing really clicked until, and I was on Match, and Match was a mixed bag. I would find that I would be like, that person looks cool. And then she would really just seem like a good friend, or, you know, it'd be people, women, they had this thing every week called Your Matches. And, you know, we think these women would be perfect for you. And it would just be like, no, I don't want to connect with that woman who is so into Snoopy that she's got like herself with every Snoopy
part. Oh gosh.
Arranged for her head.
Right. Oh my goodness.
So I was like, fail. And a whole year had gone by since I left my ex, and I was pretty much ready just to stop trying to date because I felt like it wasn't really panning out. And then I got an email that said Your Matches, and I just randomly clicked on it. I don't know, like sometimes you click on stuff and you're like, why did I just click on that? I didn't even want to open it, but I did. And there was this picture of this woman who completely took my breath away. And long story short, we're married now.
Wow.
Her name is Laura, and we got married in New York 2 Octobers ago. And she's definitely the love of my life. And she had actually been looking at my picture on Match before she joined. I was kind of like the bait for her.
So interesting. When I was
the first person, she had put her stuff up like 10 p.m. the night before. I looked at it at 9 in the morning. When I reached out to her, it was just like so cool. I mean, here I'd been banging around on Match for a year, having like ridiculous dates, and she was just on Match for 8 hours, and there I was, the first person she liked. So we've been together for 5 years. 5 years on March 2nd. So, that was our first date, and it's just been amazing. And of course, you know, reality is reality, and I think I learned a lot about how not to be a jerk in the, you know, a relationship just from my last one and mistakes I made. And so I think that's a good thing for this relationship. And you know, she had never thought about being a mom.
Mm-hmm.
So she's come a long way with my kids. She's watched them grow up for 5 years.
Right.
And been a really amazing person in their life. And she provides things that my ex and I just don't really have in our
wheelhouse. Yeah.
You know, she provides things that I just, that neither my ex or I really have in our areas of expertise. Like, she's, you know, amazing at art history and also at like household projects, home improvement. So I feel like she makes, the kids' lives very rich and in addition to, just being a wonderful person for me.
Now Laura cooks as well, right? You guys both cook?
Well,
or do you do the most of the cooking?
The funny thing is her mom grew up, she grew up in the Midwest, and her mom had the meatloaf one day.
Right.
But she actually makes this chicken green chili tortilla casserole that my kids, it's their very favorite thing in the whole world. And it's so old school. It has chicken, cream of chicken soup.
Oh, yeah. Good old Midwestern food.
Yeah. But it's delicious. And I think it's, I love that their favorite meal is what she makes and what her mom made.
Mm-hmm.
It's just one of those unexpected things where I'm like, great, they love something.
Right. Yeah.
It's actually, you know, not just pizza or hamburgers.
Yeah. Well, so to wrap up, you know, the one thing that I loved while reading, and I'm not quite done yet, although I did skip to the end, although I already knew how your story ended up. I'm one of those people sometimes wants to read the end of the book before I'm done with it.
You can do that. That's okay.
But I do love the structure of how each of the phases of your life, you sort of had a cookbook that you associated with that phase, or that you used to sort of weave the narrative about that phase of your life. So when it was the Martha Stewart or the Molly Canson book. So if you had to pick, like, what would be the cookbook of your life right now?
Oh, I would say that it would be the Yotam Ottolenghi book called Jerusalem, which is there's several reasons why it would be the cookbook of my life right now. One is that he's an Israeli, and his chef, like his partner in chefdom, not in life, is Palestinian, and it's about that cross fertilization.
Okay.
So I love it because it talks to how our most paradoxically different parts of ourselves or our lives can be married into something that's greater than the sum of its parts and that's unexpectedly good. if we just try to, you know, let them exist together. Another thing that I love about that food or that cookbook is that it's so incredibly delicious. And when he was making, I think he still writes for one of the big London papers. And what he wanted to do was make recipes, you know, that you could just go to the grocery store and everything would be there. So although there are a couple things that just really don't exist in American supermarkets, most of them do. And so you can make these incredibly unique, new to you recipes that that really don't have crazy run all over the state, you know, order stuff online kind of ingredients. And it just, it's also like very much a lot of recipes. A lot of the meals are wonderful for dinner parties, and I love to entertain. So when I made for my 40th birthday, I had a dinner party where I invited like really close friends, and I made like four things from that cookbook, and it went over super well. And you know, so that's basically why it's my favorite cookbook right now. I think that I'll probably have another one next month, but at this point in my life, I'm enjoying them. I'm not like looking for them to teach me how to live.
Right. Yeah. They're more of a way for you to experiment or, just enjoy where you are with cooking. You're not like, they don't define you.
it's like I'm sitting back and I'm growing, but I'm not surviving. It's
right.
Like, throw me that rope/cookbook.
Please, Martha, help me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Like refining what I know. I think that's something we all feel as we get older.
Mm-hmm.
Just that in my 20s, I was just anxious all the time. Like, what was my life going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And so scary. And in my 30s, I was like, my life's not what I wanted it to be, but what is that? And how do I get it to be that?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened in my 30s. And now I'm just like in a really great place to just grow.
That's great.
Enjoy like being in the right place. So, I mean, I hope most people don't have to do it that way, but I'm so happy it happened. In my mid 30s, I was thinking, when I'm on my deathbed, am I going to actually feel like I had the life I was supposed to? And the answer was no. And that was the engine that caused me to change all sorts of things in my life. And I'm glad I did.
That's awesome. And we will link to, I want to definitely link to like your Huffington Post story about finding that picture of yourself. I'd love to link to that New Yorker story too, because I think that'd be really interesting. So if you go to the show notes, which will be at listeners, at thekitchenhour.com/episode11, you will find links. And I also want to link to some of the cookbooks you mentioned, including that last one. That sounds great.
Yeah, I can send you, I'll send you a list so that you don't have to f- around.
Yeah.
It actually didn't make it into Huffington Post. It was on
I thought it was
another blog.
You're in HuffPo all the time though, so.
Yeah. For some reason that didn't connect too much, but there is a blog where it lives, and I can send you that link. I can send you links to just like Twitter and all that.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, that would be great. So, if you're listening to this and you want to find out more, definitely check the show notes. Again, the book is Licking the Spoon, a memoir of food, family, and identity. It's available everywhere now. Mm-hmm. So definitely look it up, Candace. It's been so wonderful having you on. It's been a great conversation, and look forward to finishing your book now.
Oh, I know. You're on the hot seat.
Yeah.
I just want to mention that there are recipes from many of those times in my life, and my relatives from Cretan to Irish to German to Cuban, and recipes I made up myself, and recipes from like just favorite recipes from different cookbooks. So you can eat what you read.
I would love to share one of those. Could I do that on the post?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. So we'll talk after this and we can decide which one. So there's another incentive to come, you know, look at the show notes and check everything out. Cause we'll include one of Candace's recipes. So very cool. Well, thanks Candace. It's been great talking with you.
Oh, wonderful. Have a great day.
To find out more about Candace Walsh, visit her website, lickingthespoonbook.com. You can also find out more about Candace and her work and get links to some of the books and articles we discussed today by going to the show notes at thekitchenhour.com/episode12.